two Georgias on my mind today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. From just outside Atlanta, Georgia, we meet the conservative Christians helping Muslim refugees build new lives in the U.S.
Some of them are my best friends. They're the most reliable, most dependable, most loving, most generous, most Jesus-like people I know. Yeah, most Jesus-like people I know are these Muslim men.
And from Tbilisi, Georgia, we go inside a giant market for Soviet-era technology and spare parts.
It is just an amazing sight to see literally rows and rows. I mean, there are hundreds of people working there selling all this stuff.
Plus, Harvard-educated lawyer Francisco Marquez got detained in his native Venezuela and ended up spending months in prison. His story and much more today here on The World. President-elect Trump made waves during the campaign when he suggested his administration might ban Muslims from entering the U.S. That kind of talk has concerned many Americans, and not just Muslim Americans. Many Christians have been helping Muslim refugees resettle here. And that's where we start today, with this story from the world's religion correspondent, Matthew Bell, just back from Atlanta, Georgia.
When Luke Keller woke up to the news that Donald Trump would be our next president, the first thing he did was pick up the phone.
I immediately called all of my Muslim friends and just reassured them that nothing's going to happen to them. Nothing's going to happen to their families. The United States, we have our problems, but we take care of ours.
Keller has lots of Muslim friends. He runs a nonprofit outside of Atlanta called the Lantern Project. It helps train refugees in the trades, and many of them, if not most, come from Muslim countries.
Teaches them certified construction. And we do welding, we do pipe fitting, we do masonry, we do carpentry, we do electrical. Our job is to have these men and women come through the program and finish and be able to obtain the high-paying jobs in the construction field.
Keller, who's 27, walked away from what could have been a high-paying job in the construction business himself, and he says his faith is a big reason.
To me, as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus, he called us to love our neighbors, period. What's something that's become very important to me is the fact that we are not loving our neighbors well. I've chosen to sacrifice to show love to these men and women that are coming in from other countries. Because really the second part to that is, if not me, then who else?
Keller says he gets the question all the time. What about American-born workers? Why not help them? First of all, he says the training program is open to anyone, not just refugees, and that this is all about supply and demand.
We struggle finding good laborers. That seems to be the major issue with, I would say, 99% of the construction companies out there. They just struggle finding good laborers.
Are you saying these guys are not taking jobs away from Americans?
I'm saying they're absolutely not taking jobs away from Americans. But the issue is that someone would rather sit in an office making $30,000 a year when they could be working out in the field, probably making double, sometimes triple that.
Najibullah Zahedi is working on his certification as a contractor. He came to Georgia as a refugee with his family in 2014. Back in Afghanistan, he worked as a translator with the U.S. military. Zahedi says he had to leave his home country because the Taliban wanted him dead.
If you be in a war zone, especially like Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, so if the enemy, the terrorists, they cannot fight with the American, they can fight with the people, they help the American. So in their idea, we are infidel because we help the American or other groups. So we need something more than thank you for the government or for the people. They support us and they help us.
As a small token of his thanks, Zahedi carved a round, 2-foot-wide U.S. congressional seal out of solid oak. He's hoping to present it to American lawmakers who approved his family's legal status as refugees. Because of Donald Trump's talk about a ban on Muslims entering the U.S., some refugees here in the country already are worried they won't be able to bring their relatives here to join them. Joshua Siwicki is with the resettlement agency World Relief, also outside of Atlanta. He says that once he's president, Trump would be able to put a stop to the refugee program very easily.
Our country's ability to receive refugees and resettle them is dictated by a presidential determination every year. Because it's a presidential determination, the president can change that at any time, as I understand it.
That's true. The chief executive has various ways of putting a stop to certain groups entering the country. Right after September 11, 2001, for example, most refugees were blocked from entering the U.S. Siewiecki describes himself as a conservative Christian. He says America can't just throw open its borders to everyone. But if people ask him about the security threat posed by vetted Muslim refugees, he tells them about the women who work at the daycare center at his church.
So these are Muslim women that we're inviting into our church to care for our children. I have three kids. The oldest is six. The youngest is 17 months. Would I hand over my 17-month-old son to a Muslim woman if I thought that his life was in jeopardy, if I thought that she wanted any ill will for him?
All right. Has anybody ever used the chalk line?
Back at the construction training school, Luke Keller tells me he has these conversations all the time. When people find out that he's helping Muslims come to America, they express serious doubts. But most Americans, he says, have never even met a Muslim before. So Keller puts it in terms his fellow Christians can understand.
I know personally, getting to have conversations, developing relationships with these Muslim men, who now some of them are my best friends. They're the most reliable, most dependable, most loving, most generous, most Jesus-like people I know. Yeah, most Jesus-like people I know are these Muslim men.
There's a lot of nervousness right now, Keller says, so everyone here is just trying to take things in stride. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Stone Mountain, Georgia.
More on refugees on tomorrow's Thanksgiving edition of The World. Donald Trump has talked about instituting a blanket ban on Syrian refugees entering the U.S. If he follows through, it could affect thousands of Syrians, especially those who are already here and hoping their families might be able to join them at some point. But some people like Trump worry that terrorists might use the refugees as cover to enter the country.
The risk of ISIS actually succeeding in getting people through our screening system far outweighs our compassion and hope to help Syrians fleeing danger.
The arguments for and against stopping Syrians from entering the U.S. That's tomorrow here on The World. Syrians aren't the only ones in Donald Trump's sights. He's spoken of prosecuting Hillary Clinton, registering Muslims in the U.S., even installing family members in key government posts. Trump says he's backed away from some of these notions, but still a word does spring to mind: autocracy. Author Masha Gessen knows a thing or two about navigating autocratic leaders. She was born in Moscow and worked as a journalist there, even managed to be a vocal critic of Vladimir Putin. Gessen now lives in New York.
There's a great temptation, and I think that temptation comes from the limits of our imagination. And the temptation is to believe that he's not as bad as all that, that he didn't mean half of what he said, and that it's just going to be politics as usual, maybe a little bit different. In my experience, in writing about Vladimir Putin, he laid out pretty much what he thought and what he wanted in his early interviews when he was still acting president, and even before that, on the rare occasions when he had a chance to express his opinion publicly. Nobody wanted to listen. People wanted to project their ideas of what he ought to be. I think that's very much what's happening with Trump now. Some people are sort of noting that, oh, well, maybe, you know, he doesn't want to build an entire wall along the Mexican border out of brick and mortar. Maybe some of it will be chicken wire. What a relief. But he hasn't stepped back from sort of the main themes of his campaign, and that's no accident. He is who he is. He ran for autocrat and he won.
I mean, candidates are bound to talk hyperbole on the campaign trail. And now I know you believe that we should believe what he says, but he keeps contradicting himself. So what are we really to believe?
Actually, I would question the premise that candidates are bound to talk hyperbole. There was a wonderful piece in The New Yorker a couple of months ago by Evan Osnos, who I think went into reporting the piece also believing that candidates usually talk in hyperbole, and discovered to his surprise that roughly 70% of what candidates promise during the campaign is actually carried out during the presidency, which seems like a very high percentage. And his hypothesis, and I think he's right, is that there's a force that these promises acquire during the campaign that sort of becomes a force of its own.
I mean, I know there's been a lot made of Donald Trump's praise for Vladimir Putin, but aren't they very different animals at the end of the day?
They're different. I don't think they're very different. Putin, unlike Trump, is not a charismatic leader. He became charismatic sort of by virtue of sitting in the magic chair. Trump has a force of personality. But I think that their key similarity is their approach to power and their understanding of power. First of all, they see power as a source of enrichment. They also see power as a source of personal affirmation. I think they also equate power with domination. Putin has built what the Hungarian political scientist Balint Magyar calls a mafia state. And it's funny, you know, when I was reading Magyar's work over the last couple of years, and he uses the image of the family to explain how a mafia state works. And now we see Donald Trump come in, and now it's a literal family. You don't even have to have sort of the metaphor of the family, because Donald Trump is bringing his literal family into running the country very gangster style.
You left a Russia that was getting increasingly authoritarian. Just remind us why you uprooted your family and how you see that decision now as we enter this Trump presidency.
I had to leave Russia because the state threatened to take away my children, because my partner and I are both women. I had faced personal threats before, but I wasn't really able to tolerate threats against my children, so we basically packed up and left. I thought it was a great decision. I now feel very strange about seeing some of the same traits rear up in American society. I feel like I sort of betrayed my kids. I told them this was the beacon of normalcy, this country, and now we're looking at the same stuff here.
So what do you suggest to champions of democracy do at this point?
You know, the Yale historian Timothy Snyder, who's been studying 20th century Europe for many years, wrote this wonderful phrase that Americans are no wiser than the Europeans, or the Germans specifically, who saw their democracy turn into a tyranny. But the difference is that we know what came before. We do have the value of knowledge collected over the years, and I think that the one mistake that countries tend to make, and it's an understandable mistake, which is to take too long to start resisting. I'm really hopeful about the number of protests that I've seen and the very decisive statements that people have made, including New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, who gave a terrific talk the other night about how New York City is going to continue to be New York City, and was very, very specific about setting down the line and saying, if there's a Muslim registry, we're not going to cooperate. If we're told to use our police to round up people for deportations, we're not going to cooperate. That's our beacon of hope. Politicians and activists and journalists who set down the current normal before a new normal can overtake it.
Author Masha Gessen has written several books, including The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up, a 15-year-old entrepreneur dreams big in the Central African Republic. This is The World. Let's now listen to a conversation I recently had with Audra J. Wolf. She's a historian of Cold War science, and recently in The Washington Post, she wrote about the persistent threat of nuclear war and the possibility that nuclear scientists could help stop it. So, Audra, thanks for being with us. What role can scientists play in preventing nuclear conflict?
One of the most important things that they can do is be a back-channel avenue of communication. It's a fairly small circle of people. Many of them have existing personal relationships or build personal relationships over time. So one of the things that they can do is to continue to talk to each other and keep the channels of communication open in the event of a crisis.
Can you give us an example of a White House administration there where there was kind of like a hardwired nuclear scientist, or let's just say scientist generically, who had the ear of the president?
During the Eisenhower administration and during the Kennedy administration, there was a cohort of nuclear scientists who had very close relationships with the president. Eisenhower had set up a president's scientific advisory council after the launch of the Soviet satellite Sputnik in 1958. And the scientists who were on that board, many of them had Manhattan Project experience. They were veterans of the American nuclear project. And so during that time period, especially from about 1958 until 1963, scientists met on their own as well as in government channels. And so many of the scientists who were federal advisors were also meeting as private citizens with other scientists from other countries.
So 9 countries now have nuclear weapons, and it's always been difficult to assess the risk of nuclear conflict. But let's consider for a moment the doomsday clock. I just looked at the webpage of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and it says the clock is still at 3 minutes to midnight, as it has been since 2015. Does the election of Donald Trump, do you think, as president, move us closer to midnight, or is it too early to say?
It very well may. You specifically mentioned the doomsday clock, and I think the group that decides where to put the clock is going to be meeting in the near future, and they've certainly been tweeting that they're considering moving it, but that remains to be seen.
So you mentioned the years right after the Cold War, some collaboration between American and Russian scientists, but those lines of communication have started to break down. Ukraine is part of the problem. Do you think it's possible, though, that that relationship between Russia and the U.S. could improve under a Trump presidency?
There are certainly optimists who hope so. The idea that perhaps Trump and Putin might have some sort of special relationship that might tamp down tensions in the same way that President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev were in some ways able to reach agreement limiting nuclear weapons because of their own relationship. My personal opinion is that that kind of optimism may be short-sighted, and it seems very clear that Vladimir Putin is a very savvy man, and hoping that Vladimir Putin has the best interest of, say, Europe at heart, that's not necessarily a given.
Audra J. Wolf is a historian of Cold War science. Really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Here's a story that should distract you from the tedium of your long holiday trip. It's about a kid named Fortuné who dreams big despite long odds. He lives in the Central African Republic. In 2013, the country was torn apart by violence. Hundreds of thousands of people were displaced. But earlier this year, the CAR managed to attain a fragile peace. And now people like Fortuné are trying to rebuild their lives. Brenna Daldorf has his story from the capital, Bangui.
At 6 a.m., the crossroads called Place Marabena are already bustling. People pile into beat-up taxis, and vendors hawk bunches of overripe bananas and SIM cards. Men lie in the dust, tinkering with a broken-down Jeep. Nearby, Fortuné stirs a pot of coffee over a small fire next to a wooden stand. When school let out for the summer, the 15-year-old saw an opportunity to make some cash selling food at Place Marabena. He borrowed money from relatives to get his business going and now peddles coffee and spaghetti to passers-by. For him, this little stand is step one to living up to his name, Fortuné. I want to be a big businessman, he says. Fortuné's tiny. He sounds and looks more like 10 than 15. But when he talks about his career, he's focused and serious. He'd like to own a fleet of taxis, he tells me, or a chain of restaurants. He'd like to support his family. But that's in the future. For now, he has customers waiting. It's really hot, he warns, as he carries coffee to a man waiting to get his car fixed. The man who works as a driver tells me he buys coffee from Fortuné 3 times a day. He says he always wants Fortuné's coffee because the little one makes it really well. Fortuné glows. He tells me the spaghetti he makes is just as good. So good that he usually sells out by noon. Spaghetti for breakfast is all the rage on Place Marabena. Fortuné has given his wooden stand a grand name. It means divine efficiency. It reflects his strategy for both business and life. One, be efficient, a good businessman. Two, pray a lot, because in the Central African Republic, it's good to keep God on your side. When I sell, I praise God, he says, and that praise touches people's hearts, and they come and buy from me. Fortuné believes that God has a soft spot for orphans like him. His unwavering faith carried him through extremely difficult times. Eyes closed, Fortuné is worlds away as he sings a hymn his mother used to sing him. The family fled their home in December 2013 after an attempted coup dissolved into violence across the capital. They ended up in a refugee camp where his mother died the following year. I miss her a lot. When I go to sleep at night, I only dream of her. Then I cry, he says. After elections earlier this year, the Central African Republic has moved into a fragile peace. Felchene and his sister now live with his great aunt, Jocelyn Kabinda, a house cleaner not far from Place Marabena.
La personne, je peux pas laisser.
She says she took them in because they had no one else. I couldn't leave them like that, she says.
Ce sont mes sons.
They're my blood. She thinks Felchene gets ahead of himself with his plans and his dreams. She wants him to focus on school and making up for the months they missed out on education. While the family uses some of Fortuné's earnings to make ends meet, most of it gets tucked away for school fees. At the moment, Fortuné is pouring his heart into what he calls a singing practice with a crowd of neighborhood kids. He throws his arms up to the sky. He sings about God, the father of orphans, and he prays that he'll become a great man despite all the odds. But a few days later, Fortuné's luck faltered. Divine efficiency was robbed by a couple of customers, and he had to shut it down. He was back at square one. In the Central African Republic, things can always fall apart. Lives fall apart, governments fall apart, peace deals fall apart. You have to be tough to keep dreaming. But Fortuné is one tough kid. And when I last spoke to him, he was already back to selling coffee and spaghetti. For The World, Brenna Deldorf, Bangui, Central African Republic.
We're rooting for you, Fortuné. Brenna's story was supported by the Great Lakes Reporting Initiative, part of the International Women's Media Foundation. This is The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Running a restaurant isn't easy, but when you serve up a rotating menu from the world's trouble spots, it's a whole different level of tough.
We received a death threat that we had to close the restaurant for a week, and it was really quite sad, especially for our local Palestinian community to see.
The story of Conflict Kitchen, that's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This next story is about Francisco Marquez. He's a 30-year-old dual citizen of Venezuela and the United States and a graduate of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Last June, Marquez was living back in Venezuela and working for the opposition party. He was out campaigning for the recall referendum against President Nicolas Maduro, and that's when he was detained and later jailed on charges of money laundering and conspiracy to incite unrest. Marquez ended up spending 4 months in various Venezuelan prisons, which he describes as dungeons. He was released last month, and he's now back in the U.S. trying to call attention to the political crisis in Venezuela.
You know, since my release, I've been talking a lot because many people know that there are political prisoners in Venezuela, but they don't realize that there's torture. I was a witness myself to many other tortures, both political prisoners and common prisoners.
And that was in the prison. I mean, tell us what the conditions were like inside that prison.
Almost no light, no sunlight, very dark, very humid, full of mosquitoes. I actually got dengue fever, very, very bad smells. And most of the time I was in my jail cell. I got scabies as well. You know, they weren't very good hygienic, both psychological conditions. And then, you know, imagine living through this and you would hear screams of people being beaten. You would actually see beatings as well. And something that's more important and why I say this is systematic, it's not like a one-off prison guard doing this. The warden of my prison, I saw him as he beat other prisoners with what all these prison guards had. They had this bat with a flat surface, and that's what they would use to beat other prisoners. And while I was not physically tortured, I was psychologically tortured, because when they beat someone in front of you for half an hour and you hear him screams, you know, they look at you and they make sure that you get the message that if, you know, you go out of line, if you do something you're not supposed to, you know, you'll get that treatment. You know, they take your clothes off, they videotape you, they take all the stuff out of your cell. They did this to me, by the way, not 10 times in one day, but, you know, I was in the middle of my dengue fever and the prison guards came in. And so they asked you to take your clothes off. They take everything away from your cell, and they do it in a very, they try to humiliate you, right? One of the things that you, through this process, is you really, it's hard to see when other people try to take your dignity away. And not just trying to be done to you, but to other prisoners. And what you really realize is, well, you know, they can't take it away from you if you don't let it.
Francisco, were you able to speak with other prisoners, and how many of them do you think were political prisoners?
Yeah, so I had 7 different cells. And yes, I talked to both non-political prisoners and political prisoners. All the prisoners that I talked to, and even prison guards, the ones that weren't obviously engaging in torture, they're against what's happening in Venezuela.
Is the tension between the U.S. and Venezuela part of the reason you think you were held for as long as you were?
Well, I mean, these processes are so hard to gauge, right? I mean, it's sort of like a black box. I could honestly make so many suppositions. But at the end of the day, what I truly know is that my arrest was political for political purposes, and that my release was thanks to multiple points of pressure, both domestically and internationally. And you really never know what the final reason is exactly, because on the day that I was released, for example, another good friend of mine was put in jail from the same party. And so you always think, well, you know, what's the decision making here? It's a very manipulative in many senses. All I know right now is that even though there are certain releases, hundreds of political prisoners continue in Venezuela. Torture continues in Venezuela. And what we need to do, as those of us who are exiled right now, is continue to put pressure on the Venezuelan government to release more prisoners and to have constitutional and peaceful change in Venezuela. Because that's what the people want. The people want change in Venezuela. They're desperate to change. And what we want to do is have an election so they express their will. Because that's, by the way, our purpose right now. The opposition coalition, that's what we want. We want a recall election. And Maduro and his courts controlled by politics has killed it. And unfortunately, that's why there's so much political tension right now in Venezuela.
So you've experienced the oppression in Venezuela firsthand. You're determined to continue your activism. What do you most want to convey about the current situation there that you think most Americans just don't get?
I think Venezuela is a ticking time bomb right now. If you can imagine having to choose between eating or buying medicines, that's how desperate the situation is in Venezuela for most of our families. And so when you look at that and you look at a government that right now is not allowing elections at all, because we were supposed to have governor elections this year and they didn't allow it. And we are petitioning a recall election and they didn't allow it. So when you look at that situation, you know, it's a ticking time bomb. And so right now, what we need to do, and American citizens and others are about to hear this, is make sure that the international community helps pressure the government so that we have free and fair elections and let people express their will. I think that's the focus right now. And know that you are dealing with a government that currently engages in having political prisoners and systematic torture within their prison system.
Francisco Marquez spent 4 months in a Venezuelan prison. He was recently released and is now back in the United States. Thank you very much for telling us your story, Francisco.
No, thank you very much for this time.
Another Venezuelan in exile who's drawing attention to political prisoners back home is cartoonist Rima Suprani. The World's Carol Hills has more.
As a child, Rima Suprani used to draw all over the walls of her home in Caracas.
Fue mi primera forma de expresión de niña.
I started drawing when I was a little girl. I think that was the way I was expressing myself. I was a shy girl and I didn't talk much, so I would just observe and draw, paint the walls.
Eventually, her mother cut a deal with her. Pick one wall, and you can draw on that, but only that. At university, she studied journalism, but then got the bug to be a political cartoonist.
Y así pude ir desarrollando esas dos vertientes. Creo que lo que me gusta de los dibujos políticos.
I think that what really draws me to being a good cartoonist is that it's like a game. You have to find out what's hidden and be able to reveal it and be able to show it to the world in a cartoon. It's fascinating.
Rima Suprani has been working steadily since college. She's in her 40s now, and for nearly 2 decades, she was a cartoonist at El Universal, a leading Venezuelan newspaper. Suprani is known as a tough but original and nuanced cartoonist. Over the years, she didn't hesitate to criticize President Hugo Chavez, the father of the left-wing populist movement known as Chavismo. So when Chavez died in 2013 and was replaced by his hand-picked successor, Nicolas Maduro, Suprani was tough on him, too, especially as the economy went into freefall. Alfredo Romero is a human rights lawyer in Caracas and a huge fan of Rima Suprani.
She's not just a cartoonist. She's more someone that interprets the moment and uses cartoons with her message. I mean, it's something incredible. Whatever she said in her cartoons are very effective. I mean, she represents the right moment, the right time, and the right message.
But in 2014, her newspaper changed hands. Its new owners were Maduro supporters, and just around the same time, Suprani happened to publish a negative cartoon about the late Hugo Chavez. It showed a flatline cardiogram with Chavez's signature, suggesting that Venezuela's failing economy could be blamed on the former president. To the new owners of her newspaper, criticizing their hero was heresy. So they fired Soprani. Venezuelan journalist Cesar Miguel Rondon says the Maduro government has no regard for freedom of the press. He calls them street punks.
They behave like punks on a corner in the street. You don't have the rule of law here. Every single day, it's more openly the exercise of a dictatorship instead of a democracy. So we don't like Rima. Rima, you should go out. That's as simple as that.
But it didn't end there. Soprani started getting death threats. She was attacked online. She got comments like, why don't you go find a man? Or, you're a prostitute. You're a lesbian.
Amenaza de mi integridad como mujer, como ser humano.
They were really attacking my integrity as a woman, as a human being. I was getting all kinds of calls, being insulted, and not just because of my work.
Since 2007, supporters of the Chavez and Maduro governments have been buying up the independent news media in Venezuela, which has had the effect of silencing the opposition. Maduro has a weekly television program and used that platform to denounce Soprani. So does his right-hand man, Diosdado Cabello. He's Venezuela's national assembly chief and functions as the attack dog for Maduro.
Algunas personas, familiares.
This is Cabello's weekly show. It's called Con el Mazo Dando, which means hitting with the sledgehammer. Cabello uses the program to cheerlead for chavismo and denounce perceived opponents of the Maduro government. On this program, he's denouncing human rights lawyer Alfredo Romero and accusing the relatives of detainees of being human rights abusers themselves. He's also used his program to denounce Rima Soprani. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has called Cabello's show a form of intimidation, and Amnesty International has denounced Cabello for regularly revealing the travel details of human rights lawyers like Alfredo Romero.
If I travel out of Venezuela, he mentioned when I'm taking this plane, at what time, and where I go, and whenever I come back, he says exactly the time that I got into the airport, the time that I get into Venezuela through the customs and all these kind of things.
Romero says his name has been mentioned by Cabello and Maduro on state TV more than 80 times over the past 2 years. But for Rima Soprani, the pressure and threats became too much. She moved to Miami 11 months ago.
En realidad, emocionalmente no nunca me quise ir de Venezuela.
Emotionally speaking, I never wanted to leave Venezuela, but it became such a risk that I couldn't live there. It sort of paralyzed me. And now I feel like I'm in a place where I can look at everything from a distance, and I can be more useful, because my creativity can flow without worrying.
Journalist Cesar Miguel Rondon says the government's suppression of Soprani worked. Her cartoons used to be a must-see daily event in Venezuela. She had the attention of the whole country. Now she's limited to social media. From exile, Soprani continues to draw about the political repression back home. One of her current projects is calling attention to the political prisoners being held in Venezuelan jails. She's drawing their pictures and telling their stories. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
You can see some of Rima Soprani's cartoons, including her drawings of political prisoners, at PRI.org. Okay, here's a question for you. How many Venezuelan restaurants are in your town? What about North Korean restaurants or Afghan? Probably not that many, if any. Well, in Pittsburgh, a small takeout restaurant has been working for years to change that, to expand locals' taste buds and their view of the world. It's called Conflict Kitchen, and reporter Ashley Cleek recently checked it out.
It started in 2010. Dawn Waleski and her friend John Rubin were talking politics and food.
We were naming cuisines that Pittsburgh didn't have to offer, and we thought, oh, there's Iranian food or Afghan food, and do people in Pittsburgh even know the difference between the two? And we realized we were naming cuisines from countries with which the U.S. government is in conflict, and that's pretty much how Conflict Kitchen was born.
The idea was simple. Maybe there was a way to introduce, through street food, some empathy for countries Americans have probably never visited and cultures that make some people anxious. At the time, in 2010, U.S. concern over Iran's nuclear program was high. So the first version of Conflict Kitchen was Iranian.
We served Iranian kubada. Kubada means ground, so it was a ground meat that we made into a sandwich. We called it an Iranian hamburger for the average Pittsburgher that had never had Iranian food.
After that, the project exploded. 6 years in, they've hosted food from North Korea, Afghanistan, Venezuela. Conflict Kitchen's not a full restaurant, rather a small kiosk in a big plaza here. And the current menu? Haudenosaunee food from the Iroquois Confederacy. It's a historical conflict with ties to today. For example, some Haudenosaunee would like to be able to use their native passports. but the U.S. won't recognize them. Around noon, dozens of customers scan the menu of juniper-braised venison and quail with a side of cornbread or succotash. For Blaine Siegel, Conflict Kitchen's director of outreach, this crowd is an opportunity for some guerrilla education in the form of a trivia show.
Now, how many federalized, recognized nations are there within the entirety of the United States? And for this, we get a little chaotic. So someone just throw out a number, and we're going to keep going until we get it.
Blaine frantically writes numbers on a big white paper. People call out guesses.
Higher than 15. 32. Higher than 32. 52. Higher than 62.
And while the idea of serving food from countries all over the world doesn't sound controversial, Conflict Kitchen has faced opposition.
I think the version that we did that received the most organized efforts against it was our Palestinian version.
That's John Rubin, one of the co-founders. He expected some grumbling when they started selling Palestinian food, but the vitriol took him by surprise.
We received a death threat that we had to close a restaurant for a week, and it was really quite sad, especially for our local Palestinian community to see that their food, their culture, and their stories were being challenged as hate speech.
Customers, however, ate up the Palestinian version. Literally. It was one of their most popular themes. Rubin takes heart in all this, knowing that he might get more people talking about what's going on in the world.
We had a student who said we're like the Daily Show for him. Like, we're the place where he learned everything he knew about Venezuela. They're curious about something, and they think we'll provide a different entry point to knowing about that culture or that country than they might find elsewhere. And I think in a small way, we're expanding the level of knowledge within our community.
Higher than 300. 1,000. Lower than 1,000. Good jump, though.
That's definitely happening in line. People keep guessing, closer and closer, just how many federally recognized nations are inside the United States. The answer? 566 federally recognized tribes. Later, I overhear a group of guys talking about why that number is so high while scarfing down some quail. For The World, Ashley Cleek, Pittsburgh.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. It'd be so easy to say this next story is about a Home Depot in Georgia. Full disclosure, Home Depot in this case is simply a metaphor for a hardware store in the Georgia I'm talking about, the former Soviet Republic. This store is really a sprawling open-air marketplace, and rummaging through the stuff on sale is like taking a trip back through the Soviet past. Journalist and artist Andrew North is based in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, and this market just spoke to him.
When I first saw this place, I mean, it is just an amazing sight to see literally rows and rows. I mean, there are hundreds of people working there selling all this stuff. And it's an incredible sight. And the artist in me thought, I've got to try drawing this. And then I think once I started it, the journalist in me then saw a wider story there.
Right. Well, you report in the usual way, you know, asking questions, recording interviews. But as you say, you also tend to draw when you're in the field. And you undertook a big drawing in this market. We'll have it at PRI.org. Those tools, though, I mean, we're not talking weapons. These are machines that almost kind of steampunk. What do these machines do?
I mean, you have got in some of the stalls old electric motors, very powerful ones, which used to drive Soviet metro, Soviet subway escalators. So some of these things are big. I mean, you know, they're really powerful old motors. You've got old Russian-made gearboxes, the kinds of things that would be used in a big machine workshop. Again, some of these motors were used for the same kinds of things. Old ventilation fans. And then on the smaller end of the scale, you've got Soviet-era nuts and bolts, Soviet saws, hammers, all these kinds of things, and which have been reconditioned, cleaned up, and then are being sold on again. And in effect, what these people are doing is they're selling the past in the hope of a new future.
Yeah, there's all this machine stuff, and then you've got old Soviet propaganda posters, even a hammer and sickle flag. I'm just curious, what does all this stuff represent today in Georgia for the people you met?
Well, you see, this is the thing, and I think this is where I found it really interesting as I spent a lot of time there and I got to know the people. It's a window on Georgia's transition which has been a pretty tough one at times since the end of the Soviet Union 25 years ago, because for the most part, people in Georgia lean west. There's a very pro-American sentiments here. But there's a lot of people who've been left behind and are not so sure with the changes that Georgia has gone through. And in a place like this market, it's called the Eliava after a street nearby, you find a lot more people who are to some extent nostalgic for the past. They miss the certainties of communist rule, and they found it a struggle. And the Eliava, this market, they hoped it would be a kind of a midway station to something better. But for many of them, it's proved to be the kind of the end of the line.
Are people buying the stuff in this market? And if they are, is it about nostalgia or is it about we need cheap stuff and this is a pretty good deal?
It's a bit of both. There's still people who are coming to buy this stuff, but a lot less than used to come. And that's why a lot of these guys are struggling. I mean, as you'd expect, because now there are more people who can afford the newer stuff. The newer stuff works better. Why would you want to buy a 60-year-old Soviet motor when you can get, a well-made, much quieter German motor, which runs a lot more efficiently and costs a lot less, you know? So it's a market that clearly doesn't have a lot of oomph left in it. And while I was there, I actually saw the changes happening. I mean, in the 4 months it took me to draw this drawing, I mean, the drawing actually is about 13 feet long, so it took quite a long time, as you
can
imagine.
It's a 360 panorama, right?
360 panorama, that's right. And, just to get that done, obviously I was there for a long time. And in that time, I saw the changes. Stalls closed down. Several people that are actually in the drawing have already moved on. So I think we can safely say this market, it doesn't, this part of the market certainly doesn't have a lot of life left in it.
So Tbilisi is also your home right now, Andrew. Did covering this story, did drawing this market kind of change the way you see your fellow citizens in Tbilisi?
It certainly did, because, one of the great things about drawing is that it's both slow and immediate. It's obviously a difficult process trying to get, an impression of someone, especially guys who are working. I have to ask them to stop for a while so I can get to kind of the outline of them. But then at the same time, once I've done that drawing, they see the results immediately. And I think just me being there meant that I could learn a lot more than I ever would have done if I'd just come down to do a quick couple of interviews, such as I would have done when I was a journalist working for television, working for radio, and doing it in this kind of very, over this extended period of time, you learn a lot more about people. And as I say, I found it very interesting to sort of find the nuances and the differences in their outlook. Because on the one hand, while there are some who are certainly miss the past, miss the Soviet past, there are plenty who see, despite all the hardships they're going through, the only alternative for Georgia is to keep going west.
Journalist and artist Andrew North, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco. Great to talk to you.
You can take a virtual tour of Georgia's Home Depot of the Soviet past. We've got some of Andrew North's drawings over at PRI.org. My guess is that if Russians were to see that old Soviet hardware bazaar in Tbilisi, they'd be singing this. Buffalo Springfield in Russian, Mugnovenya Stoy. It's pretty much a direct translation of their tune for what it's worth. This is by the Russian band Disco, and it's from the 70s. You know, there is something happening here, and what it is ain't exactly clear. Applicable to so many situations these days, really. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great Thanksgiving. Как жить? Может, не успеть?
PRI, Public Radio International.